Well, good afternoon to all of you. It's delightful to see such an ugly, gray, miserable, rainy day. It's been so long in the coming, you begin to forget you live in the Northwest. Someone was asking about the drive up from Portland. I said, well, other than being wet, miserable, and gray, it was beautiful. And I can't wait to see the sunshine again, to see the fact that there will probably even be snow on the Olympics and a few other places. I'd like to thank Mr. Sexton for the opportunity to speak, and also thank him and all of the Tacoma crew for the work they have done to put together a special teen weekend. When Seattle notified us earlier in the year that they were not going to be able to get the halls that they needed, I know, at least for our end of the circuit, the teens began to panic, as did some of the adults who were working with them, about the loss of opportunity. And it was delightful to see the Sextons and Tacoma congregation pick up the slack and provide the opportunity. So it's good to see all of you here. Before getting into the message, I did receive a notation. Again, when this kind of weather comes after such a long sunny spell, not all of us remember to turn our headlights off. So one of you needs to save an automobile battery. You own a red Plymouth with a license plate 151 something LF. And for the sake of your battery, you probably need to go out and turn your headlights off. Other than that, the rest of you done fairly well. You know, it's amazing as time goes by and as the years go by that you forget how much time passes because you're so involved in the moment, in the day, in the year. And when Mr. Sexton asked if I would come up and speak, I was looking, thinking as ministers do, about what to speak about. And normally you don't like to repeat sermons you've given before. I looked at a sermon that I had given before, in an altered form, and got to thinking. I gave this sermon at a regional YOU weekend in Pasco when all the churches in the Northwest came together for their annual talent show, their annual basketball event, and their annual art and photography exhibits. And I looked at the notes and they read December 1992, and I stopped and I said, you know what? The youngest of the teens in this room weren't born when I gave that sermon. And the oldest teens in this room had entered the first grade 4 months before the sermon. Considering that, I think it's safe to give a sermon to teens who probably were not paying a lot of attention at the last time I gave it. And for the youngest, we're not capable of paying any attention. You weren't here yet. I asked the question, and I ask it again, who are the greatest people in the world? As you think about that, you can come at it from several different directions. I'm going to come at it from two primary, several secondary, but from the standpoint of how the world measures greatness or how it assumes greatness and how God sees greatness. By the time we're finished with the sermon, we'll find that there are very different views between what we accept as norms here in our society and what God accepts as a norm in his society. In our society, one of the measurements of greatness was best described by a man of great wealth a generation ago. He had a rather interesting and straightforward assessment of life. He said, "Life is a game, and money is how you keep score." And he happened to have enough. He was scoring very well. He was among the wealthiest men on the face of the earth. And so his particular assessment was a pat on his own back. He said, look, let's face it. Life is about the accumulation of money. That's how you keep score. And I'm winning big time. One thing you can't argue about, and that is that wealth is power. There is no question about that. But does wealth make someone great? Powerful? Absolutely. Great? You know what? You and I live in a democratic nation. And in a democratic nation, money, in many cases, is your business. And it doesn't necessarily mean I would even know who you are if I met you on the street. I would dare say this audience as a whole, if they were walking down the streets of an American city, could walk past at least 8 or 9 of the wealthiest people in the world and never know the event happened. So you can have phenomenal wealth. It doesn't mean outside the circle of the people that you are a part of or that you influence, that you as an individual mean much of anything to anyone else. I'm going to give you the names of the 10 richest people on the face of the earth. And as I read them, you keep tally of how many you know. Because I'm going to ask you at the end of reading the 10 to let me know by a show of hands who you know. Now, because of the part of the country we're in, we've got a leg up. And in one sense, we don't need a leg up on one because it's probably known everywhere on the face of the earth. But here are the 10 richest people on the face of the earth, according to Forbes magazine at the beginning of the year 2005. So this is the current list. Looks quite different than last year's list. I was telling my wife, I said, I think the change in the value of the dollar against the euro completely turned the list upside down. About half of the 10 richest people on the face of the earth last year were all members of the Walton family and owners of Walmart stock. And they've disappeared. And not because Walmart's gone south, it's probably simply a relative issue. So let me read to you the top 10, the 10 richest people on the face of the earth. You consider how many you know. William Gates III. I got a gimme, don't we? Warren Buffett. Lakshmi Mittal. Carlos Slim Helou. Prince Al-Walid bin Talal al-Saud. Ingvar Kamprad. By now you're sitting there saying, who on earth is he talking about? Paul Allen. Carl Albrecht, Lawrence Ellison, and S. Robson Walton. 10 richest people on the face of the earth. How many of you knew half of them? Not a bad show. How many of you knew 7 out of the 10? Okay, we got 4. Any of you know all 10 of them? Okay. How many of you knew 3 or less? Okay. See, these are very, very influential people in my life. Other than Bill Gates, well, I shouldn't say that. I know Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Paul Allen, and S. Robson Walton. I know 4 of the 10. The other 6? As the old saying goes, I wouldn't know them from Adam. Ingvar Kamprad, you would know from the fact that he owns the IKEA store chain. So you would know him by association. Anyone that's seen an IKEA store, this gentleman is a Swedish individual who owns the company. The rest of them, some are in finance, some are in steel, some are in Germany, some are in the United States. And you and I don't know them. And so in terms of the question, who are the greatest people in the world? These certainly are rich people. But beyond the fact that they have wealth, they don't impact your life. They don't impact my life. And in terms of significance, they are really insignificant in terms of the day-in, day-out life that you and I lead. Just as the majority of you raised your hand that you knew three or less of these people, you made a statement. Most of these people are unknown by our generation, which means they are more likely to be even less known by future generations. They will simply pass into anonymity as their generation passes and they die. I remember as a young boy in the town that I grew up in, reaching that age of consciousness where you could read and start asking questions. And every time we drove by the library in the town we lived in, I noticed its name, and I finally asked my mother one day, well, why is this called Carnegie Library? I didn't know anybody named Carnegie. The town wasn't named Carnegie. And of course, at that particular point in time, an extremely wealthy steel magnate of the last century, last meaning the 18th into the early 19th, had donated vast sums of money to build public libraries open to anyone and everyone who wanted to use them. And they were the front end of America's public libraries. Most of those buildings have passed in time, and the name Carnegie on a library has all but disappeared. I honestly can't remember the last time I've seen Carnegie and library together on a functional building. Time goes, people disappear from memory, and their greatness dies with them. So we've just looked at a category, people who have money. Every one of these individuals is worth multiple billions of dollars. There's no one in the top 10 that is worth under double digit in the billions, 10 billion, 20 billion, 30 billion, 40 billion. They're all powerful people. By our assessment, they're not that significant. And so their greatness is questionable. Since we use that as a measurement, let's move into a second category, and that is fame as a measure of greatness. Now you move into a category where if I ask, do you know this name, I can list off names that almost every hand in the auditorium will go up. Absolutely, I know that name. Yes, I've heard that name. In fact, I wish the name would fall off the television screen or somewhere else so I could have some peace. Okay? Fame? Absolutely, positively. If wealth isn't by itself a measure of greatness, since you didn't know the wealthy people, then how about fame? Who are the best known people in the world as a class? Not as individuals, but as a class. Who are the best known people in the world as a class? I don't know how many of you are history students or you think in terms of history. I like to stand off from where I live today, look at the world from a little bit of a distance, think about it, ponder it. It's really quite fascinating because we're in a strange, strange time in terms of all of mankind's history. Because an answer to the question, and all of you know the answer to the question, who are the most well-known people on the face of the earth? The answer to that comes immediately and quickly. The best known people on the face of this earth are actors, singers, and athletes. Those are the classes of people that are universally known. It doesn't matter where you go. For those of you who have traveled widely, you can go into the most remote portions of the face of this earth, literally, and find people wearing baseball caps and t-shirts with the very same faces and names on them that you would have in the streets of Seattle or Portland. The fame of these people is universal. Interestingly enough, the best known people on the face of the earth contribute fundamentally nothing to the substance of life. When you look at what they do and what they contribute, their fundamental contribution across the board, all three classes, is to simply occupy our idle time. Their service to humanity in the area where they have become known is to simply keep us from getting bored. And that's why they exist. That's how they became known. That's what they do. The majority of them are storytellers, either as actors or as singers, springing from the old Middle Eastern troubadour who went around with songs to entertain. And so we in the 21st century are living in a time when the best known people as a class are simply those who occupy the time when we would normally be bored. Are they great? Is the fact that they're universally known, the same as saying they are great? If you read any of, I was going to use a yellow journalism term, and I'll back up from that. I was going to use the term tabloid. Forget the tabloids. Use the sources that are considered to be reputable. Publications like People magazine, or some of the television entertainment programs. Those are not in the yellow journalism tabloid class. They'll simply talk about people's lives, where they are, what they've done, where they're going, what they're dealing with. And sadly, in this particular class of people are some of the sorriest members of our society in terms of character and morality. Now, that isn't a broad brush, because I could also give you names of people who have been very honorable. Their lives have been very honorable. I'm simply saying within that class are many whose lives are a tragedy. Constantly in and out of some form of rehab. Going through marriages and relationships with phenomenal speed. Struggling within themselves, and I'm simply talking from those interviews where they reveal their own problems and their own dilemmas. They're not a role model as a class. Their values are not values to strive to imitate as a class. And so as a class, if you ask the question, are they great people? Hardly. Names like Johnny Depp, Renee Zellweger, Britney Spears, Jennifer Lopez, Eminem, and on and on we could go, are names that everyone knows. Wasn't a name there that I mentioned that all or most of the people in this room would say, yeah, I know that name, I know the face, I would recognize the person, I can even tell you biographically all sorts of things about them. Are any of them truly great? They're famous. I don't know that any that I have named deserve the title great. Fame is one thing. Greatness is something completely different. I mentioned there were three classes of people at the beginning of that point. Actors, singers, athletes. I separated athletes out of this group because their fame comes from skill, strength, speed, coordination, or endurance. And so there is something there in a mechanical sense, either genetically. Most of you who have known good athletes do understand the term gifted. Most of those who excel start out several notches above where the average person starts, and then through very diligent effort proceed upward. I don't know how many of you who have been involved in athletics have ever had the opportunity to be a part of a team or in a school setting where there was someone who was a gifted athlete. If you're not a gifted athlete and you're in the same program with someone who is, you spend your time simply saying, it is amazing to watch that whatever they set their hand to, they start out where most people end up, and then they work up from there. You do have to admire the giftedness that they have. And you can't take away from the amount of time and effort and hard work that many of them put into moving from that plateau upward. When you look at the Olympics, for instance, and you look at gymnasts or skaters, for instance, and you see from the time that they're this tall upward that they are dedicating phenomenal amounts of their life to develop their skill, how can you take that away from them? How can you discount it? Hard work is hard work, and you have to admire hard work. Achievement is achievement. You have to admire achievement. But you know, back in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, Solomon made an observation, and life has borne out Solomon's observation thousands of times over. In Ecclesiastes chapter 9, as Solomon was observing life and where life was going and what life was all about, he wrote this comment. He had already done considerable observation, and he stopped to take a breath, a mental breath. He stopped to take a mental breath from all of his thinking and to back up and just look around, stroke his chin for a moment, move back inside of his mind and think. And he said in verse 11, I returned and saw under the sun the following thing. So I said, you know, I thought about it, and then I came back to everything I'd been thinking about to sort of sum it up. And that's what he's saying here. I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. Now, there's an application in this frame that we're dealing with right now, that of athletic strength, skill, speed, and endurance. There's a frame that that setting provides for this verse. And the frame is this. In the world of sports, there are certain people whose names are legendary, and they are extremely few in number. There are other people whose accomplishments are arguably every bit as exemplary and every bit as astounding, who pass quickly out of the public remembrance. One goes on to be legend. The other passes into anonymity. I returned and I saw under the sun that time and chance happens to everyone. The best racer is not always remembered. The strongest warrior is not always remembered. The wise man is not always rewarded for his wisdom. And men of understanding do not necessarily receive remuneration commensurate with their understanding. That people of skill are not always recognized for their skill. My son and I were talking last night. We just got into one of those conversations that one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And I was talking about a little, I was talking about woodworking in a little shop up in Longview. And he recalled back that he had worked with a lady whose husband was a master craftsman, restoration of fine wood antiques, the ability to build absolutely stunningly beautiful wooden pieces. And he had been on a television program, I forgot the name of the program, but he'd been on one of these programs that features unusual or extraordinary people, and he had been on that program for one reason. He was totally, completely blind, and yet did absolutely exquisite antique restoration and fine wood furniture building, and completely, totally blind. There are people of extraordinary skill that you and I may in a lifetime never even hear about. So fame, recognition, the acclaim of greatness, not always given to everyone based upon their accomplishments. I'll ask you a timely question, and for those of you who know the question, you immediately know the timeliness. How many of you know the name Susan Butcher? Keep the hands up, because this is one I want to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 hands out of this congregation even know the name. And two of them I drop off because if they didn't know the name, I'd be ashamed of them. And that's the Sextons, and you'll understand in just a moment why. Now, the timeliness of the statement is one of the greatest, and obviously this is the area that sports talk shows are built around, but arguably one of the greatest female athletes in the 20th century, whose accomplishments, the pinnacle of her accomplishments, were made only 15 years ago. So she's not back in antiquity somewhere, she is current. Was only known by 13 people in this room. I mentioned her name because she distinguished herself in an event that is ongoing right now. Or is it ongoing or have they finished it yet? Still ongoing. It's been going on this last week. Susan Butcher was a developer and trainer of sled dogs. She won her first Alaskan Iditarod in 1986. And she went on to become the only person in history to win this more than 1,000-mile-long race five times. And only 13 of you even knew who she was. And so Solomon said, time and chance happens to all. If I say Babe Ruth, you all know. If I say Susan Butcher, you say, who's Susan Butcher? Her accomplishments are only 15 years old. Babe Ruth's 70 years old. One is remembered as a part of the fabric of our nation. The other's already been forgotten. There are very few people in the world of sports who will attain to permanent greatness. I mentioned the name Babe Ruth, probably the most renowned individual athlete in American history. Michael Jordan, as time goes by, and Wayne Gretzky, as time goes by, only time will prove whether they stay in that rarefied atmosphere down through time. If 50 years from now, Michael Jordan is a household name in the same way Babe Ruth is, then he will have joined that rare group. Wayne Gretzky, Muhammad Ali. You know, after you get finished with 5 to 10 names, everything sort of passes into mediocrity. In the world of football, it seems that great record holders replace former great record holders with such rapidity that someone who was great 10 years ago is just another name in the Football Hall of Fame today. There are some people who are known by one generation, and two or three generations later, they have passed into oblivion. How many of you are 60 and older in the room? Okay, reasonable representation. For those of you who are 60 and over, how many of you know the name Johnny Weissmuller? Okay, fine. For those of you who are 30 and younger, how many of you know the name Johnny Weissmuller? Two hands, age 30, three or four hands, 30 years old and younger. The 60 and overs remembered him because he was a part of their generation. Now, I could ask the same question of those who of you who are 60 and over. Yeah, I think we can still do a visual on this one. How many of you knew Johnny Weissmuller because, solely because, okay, no other reason, solely because of his athletic accomplishments? Okay. About half to a third of the hands that knew him otherwise. Johnny Weissmuller was the very first movie Tarzan. So when Tarzan first went on the movie screen, the very first individual to portray Tarzan in Hollywood was Johnny Weissmuller. And it didn't come as a surprise that those who were 60 and older knew the name, and that probably two-thirds of those who raised their hands knew the name because of his connection to the movies. Johnny Weissmuller, on the other hand, is one of the greatest swimmers in the history of swimming. He is, in any count of swimming accomplishments, one of the 10 greatest swimmers of all time. And that's why I was asking the question, how many knew him for his sports accomplishments? During the 1920s, Johnny Weissmuller held every world record for freestyle swimming from the 100 yards to the half mile concurrently. 100. Of course, now we have meter races, but then there were yard races. The 100 yard, the 220, the 440, and the 880. He held the world record in all of them. He set 51 world records. And in a time where great swimmers are knocking great swimmers off the pedestal repeatedly, his record in the 100 yard freestyle stood for 17 years before somebody was fast enough to beat him. And by the time you get down to the generation that's 30 and younger, they don't even know his name. See, this is the way life is. When I ask the question, who's great? The list of people who have done great accomplishments in this area are hundreds. Most of them, nobody knows. You could run a list of dozens and dozens of great athletes past a person like myself, and I've been in athletics from the time I was a child, and I'm sure there would be many, many, many of them that I'd simply say, well, I know the name, but I don't ask me why they should be in a hall of fame, why they should have recognition and prestige. Some athletes are great and remembered. Other athletes are great and forgotten. As Solomon said, time, chance, happens to all. Being physically gifted with strength, speed, or endurance, and even developing that to its maximum, does not make you great or memorable. How many of you know the greatest collection of, well, I'll have to put it this way. The Bible does not focus on athletics. And so athletic prowess would have to be connected with a slash to military skill. In the ancient world, rare were people who were simply athletes. They were warrior athletes. Their athleticism was demonstrated in battle conditions, and that is where their notoriety came into being. David had the greatest collection of warrior athletes right at his elbow in all of biblical time. In terms of the pantheon of great warrior athletes, David had them. There were three that were directly under him, and then the Bible says there were another three that were absolutely phenomenal, but not quite up to the standard of the previous three. You know any of their names? No. Can you imagine a man standing in physical combat with a sword, and when the battle is over, he personally has taken 300 lives? If you think running a mile is a great accomplishment, or running a marathon is a great accomplishment, or lifting 500 pounds in a weightlifting competition is an accomplishment, or if swimming the mile is an accomplishment, try wielding a sword long enough to take the lives of 300 men. And there's not a marathoner around, there's not a mile swimmer around, and there's not a weightlifter around that would even be standing on their feet after that level of exertion. David's mighty men were phenomenal, and yet nobody knows their names. I mean, who remembers a name like Joseph Bathabeth? Well, that's on everybody's tongue. Eliezer, the son of Dodo. Well, you could remember the Dodo. But Eliezer is one of those guys that you wouldn't want to make fun of his last name. Shammah. Well, I know Shamu, but I don't know Shammah. Well, okay. Abishai, Benaniah, Asahel, six of the greatest athlete warriors in the history of the Bible. Probably nobody knows any of their names. In the time of David, there was a warrior who was capable of outrunning a horse. And that if a man took off to flee on a horse, this man could overtake him. You know any runners today, no matter who they are, that can outrun a horse? Well, out of the blocks for the first 25 to 50 feet, not even in a 100-yard dash, let alone for any distance. Anyone know the name of David's soldier who could outrun a horse? No. Athletic greatness, even by itself, does not make a great person, doesn't make a memorable person. Doesn't mean that anybody cares one way or the other after their life is gone and passed, what they did, how fast they could run, what they could lift, or what they could do. You know what? There are many people who are actors, singers, and athletes who understand that profoundly. That as they mature in their lives and they look at what they've accomplished and they look at even the fact they may have Oscars on their mantle, Olympic gold medals in picture frames, they look at their musical, acting, or athletic accomplishments and they assess themselves and they say, this isn't good enough. We were sitting at the breakfast table just talking about a few individuals whose names have a better chance of being remembered because of where they went after acting was the sole focus in their life, or some other spotlight, than simply relying on their career as actors. And some of them were rather mediocre examples, so these are not all stellar examples. And I'm going to give you two. One is an actor, the other is a businessman. But two names that are well-known in America, Robert Redford, Ted Turner. As I said, we give Ted Turner an athletic attachment. He's owned a baseball franchise for a long period of time. But Robert Redford and Ted Turner have a good chance of being remembered through time for their nature conservancy than their wealth or their acting. In the end of it all, Paul Newman may end up being better known for where the money from his salad dressing went than for the sting. And one individual, hands down, no argument, nobody will even question the relationship, is an individual that won an Olympic gold medal in rowing in 1924, who, based on that accomplishment, would long ago have faded from American memory, whose name is known around the world for his concentration on the family and child rearing. His name is Benjamin Spock, who would have long ago been forgotten for his gold medal in the 1924 Olympics, but who will probably not be forgotten for some time into the future because of the contribution in this area. The greatest illustration I can think of was a potential nobody whose life would have ended up as nothing more than a list on a list of individuals who starred in B-rated cowboy movies, who will now be forever a part of American history. And his name is Ronald Reagan. These are examples, and they're just for instances. They're not by any means a complete list or even approaching a complete list, but these are for instances of people in certain areas of endeavor who came to the point of realizing that greatness goes beyond fame and recognition. How does the Bible define greatness? Who are great people according to the Bible? Where is the greatest single list of great people in the Bible? The answer to that is Hebrews chapter 11. If you read Hebrews 11 from its first verse to its last verse, and all of you who know the familiar names for portions of the Bible realize Hebrews 11 as the faith chapter. Hebrews 11 is simply a biblical version of a great reality that is passed down through time, and that is that truly great people come out of hard times. Truly great people rise in times of challenge and meet the challenge. Every individual listed here was an individual who was challenged. And those challenges came in two forms. They came in the form of the choice between preserving and losing their lives, and simply listening to God and being willing to stay faithful to God, waiting for His promise, in some cases, for the better part of a lifetime without quitting. Those are the measurements that come out of Hebrews chapter 11. When you look at Enoch and Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, Moses' parents and Moses, Joshua and Rahab, those are the names of the people who are named as individuals. They are all named for one of two reasons. All of them fit under the umbrella of faith. The faith to say to God, God, it doesn't matter whether I lose my life in the pursuit of what you've called me to, I will remain loyal. Or the other half, God, you have made promises to me. I can recite those promises back to you verbatim. I have waited for years and nothing has been delivered, and I will not budge from my loyalty to you, not one inch left, not one inch right, because I will trust you to the end. That's what this entire list is about. That's what every single solitary name on this list is about. You and I can't live in this life because of the limitations that are on us compared to people of old. You and I can't live long enough in this life to even come close to enduring as Noah endured. Noah was probably considered a social nutcase for longer than any of you will live, as he built a ship, not a boat, 600 feet, well past any boat size, and said, I'm doing it because God told me to. He said, the day is coming where I will bury this earth in water, and I hope that as many of you as can will join me. And in the description that is contained in Genesis 6, where it said God looked down on the world and every thought of the imagination of man's mind was evil continuously, you can't imagine what Noah put up with in the form of scorn and ridicule for 100 years. It's one thing to be told as a husband and a wife who can't have children that you'll have children. It's another thing to be told that after you've already passed the whole biological cycle. And it's another thing to believe it when the promise was given to you 24 years ago and nothing's happened. But the fact that he never changed who he was or what he was, and then when the child was finally given, to have God say to you when he reached his teenage years, take him out onto a mountaintop, put him on an altar and sacrifice him, and never even blink. To set your alarm clock, so to speak, an hour earlier than you normally get up and take off for the mountain with enough wood and with a boy. And when Abraham was finished, God said, you know what? You're at the top of my list. You are the father of the faithful. And every single solitary promise that I'm going to make to mankind, I will make under your name. Now that's great. That's real great. That's not transitory acting, singing, athletic skill. It isn't spending a lifetime saying, I was able to make $20 billion. This is true greatness. When the individuals had all been named, the writer realized the list is so long that I don't have the space to cover everyone who deserves it. And so he said, beginning in verse 32, he says, "And what more shall I say?" He said, "The time would fail me." I don't have enough space or time to give you the whole list. He said, "The time would fail me to tell you of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and of David and Samuel and of the prophets and all the other people like them who did these things, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. And do you know what God thought of them all? He said, of whom the world was not worthy." You see, there's a hall of fame that will last for eternity when all of the halls of fame that exist on this world are nothing but a pile of rubble. The footballs, the hockeys, the baseballs, the basketballs, the acting skills, the music awards, and all the rest have been forgotten and passed into oblivion. There will be one in heaven that will exist forever. And he said, you know what? These individuals, who I don't even have the time to name, this world is not even worthy of having had their time. And I do have them permanently recorded. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and in caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, haven't yet received their awards. Because God has provided something better for you and me, that they will not be made perfect apart from us. In other words, the awards ceremony for everyone will be at the same time. And you get a chance to be there also, among them, part of them. Who was the greatest person who lived in biblical times? And in case your mind is going to Jesus Christ, forget it. He's off limits on this one. Okay? Put Christ aside. Who's the greatest human being to live in the entirety of biblical times? Now, this is a simple question because the Bible tells you. You see, you don't have to guess, and it's not something that we have to argue because there is no argument. Matthew chapter 11, verse 11 tells you exactly who it was. So it's not debatable. Jesus Christ, and of course you have the world's foremost authority giving the answer, so you can't argue with the source either. In Matthew 11, 11, Jesus Christ said to his disciples, "Assuredly I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist. But he who is least, when we finally get to the kingdom, will be greater than John." As I said, when the day comes that God unveils his awards ceremony, everyone at the ceremony will have topped John. But the greatest man who lived in the entirety of biblical times, according to the words of Christ himself, was John the Baptist. I won't take you too far into John the Baptist's life. I'll let you ponder that one. There are very important biblical reasons why John resides where he does. He was a man of achievement and a man of humility. He was a man who never forgot his place in the scheme of things. At the time when Christ came along, John was the most popular person in the entirety of Israel. People came from every corner of that part of the world to see him. And when Christ came along, he disappeared into the fabric of the background and simply said, "My job was to prepare the way for someone greater than I. I have accomplished that achievement. It is time for me simply to fade." In a world of carnality, people do not reach the pinnacle and fade graciously. It takes a tremendous degree of spirituality to rise to the level of John the Baptist and to graciously retreat. There's more to his life, but as I said, I'll leave some for you to ponder. Great in the Bible has nothing to do with great in this world. And when it's over, it will be God who will assess eternal greatness. Some of you are already ascribing to yourselves qualities of greatness in the kingdom of God. And the ones who are doing it most successfully don't even know it. Parallel to greatness. For the 10 wealthiest people, their greatness has given them money. To the Hollywood great, their greatness has given them recognition. To the athletic great, their greatness has given them recognition and trophies and awards. As a biblically great, if you can ask for anything if you can ask for anything you want as one of the biblically great, what would you want more than anything else? I can tell you something that you should want more than anything else. You should want to hear with your ears the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into my kingdom." You can't get any better than that. There isn't anything you can have that is better than hearing that sentence. In Matthew 25, verse 31, Jesus Christ, as he was concluding his ministry, said, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.'" And he doesn't even stop to breathe as he continues to say, "For I was hungry, and you gave me food. And I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then those who are great, and I'm rewording this verse, because that's really what it's about, will answer him saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison?" And the king will answer and say to them, "I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." There are going to be people who will be eternally great. And part of their greatness is the fact that it is so genuine. They aren't even doing it for reward. The Bible, as a final scripture, brethren, addresses directly the question that I asked you at the beginning. And as such, it serves very well as my final quote. Turn back to Luke chapter 22. You want to know who the great are in this world? They are, by the way, the same people who will be great in the next world. But they're very neatly described in Luke chapter 22 and in verse 24. But there was also rivalry among them, that's the disciples, as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. But you are those who have continued with me in these trials, and I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me." Christ asked and answered the question of the sermon as they were jockeying and trying to one-up one another and attain to, "I am number one." And he said, "Let me tell you how to become the greatest." Every one of you here needs to realize, in response to the question of who are the greatest people in the world, that as odd as it may seem, because there are very few in this room, very few of us, who have a long and profound list of accomplishments, that the answer to the question, nonetheless, in the absence of all of that, is potentially you are. You currently have the front seat. You also have the formula, which few truly understand. And with the help of the Holy Spirit of God, you have the power to apply it. You right now are sitting in the front row of those who stand to be labeled for eternity the greatest people in the world. Use the opportunity and use it wisely.